And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State versus Edward E. Hood. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. Ms. Shalupka, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Hevekin. May it please the court, members of the bench, my name is Marin Lynn Shalupka. I am here out of Scotts Bluff, and I'm here on court appointment at the Garden County District Court. Judge Weimer had appointed me after the sentencing in this case. I want to begin by thanking the court for its interest in this case and moving this case to its docket. There are some interesting questions that this case presents and some opportunities for this court to answer some yet unanswered questions in the Nebraska law. One of which is whether the state can prove a critical element of the charged offense through a document when there's no right to cross-examine or confront someone about that element. A second question presented by this case is whether the state can present evidence that a citizen or a person has refused consent to a warrantless search. And the third question presented by this case is whether the trial counsel for Mr. Hood was ineffective in not exploring his mental capacity. I'm hoping that all three of those get argued this morning. I'm a realist and know that that's unlikely, but they're all in my brief. And I'll start, I think, by saying generally that Mr. Hood is currently serving a series of lengthy consecutive sentences right now for motor vehicle homicide and manslaughter of Ms. Terry Hofer and the DUI causing serious bodily injury of Ms. Hofer's passenger in a two-vehicle collision. After the collision, law enforcement and medical personnel both identified that Mr. Hood was behaving erratically. He made a series of bizarre statements. He was fixating on a flock of birds and messages that God was sending him. And he initially refused to give consent to a warrantless search of his blood. Mr. Hood's trial counsel did not seek evaluation of Mr. Hood's competency either at the time of the collision or any time thereafter in the pretrial and trial phase of this case. At the trial, the state was allowed to present evidence of Mr. Hood's refusal to consent to the warrantless search of his blood. The state was also allowed to prove the cause of death through a death certificate that was signed by the county attorney as coroner without any sponsoring witness. And so that'll be the first point of my argument, unless somebody here wants to divert me from it. Ms. Hofer's death certificate was signed by Phil Pierce, who is the Garden County attorney. And he served as the coroner, but he is not a medical professional. Mr. Pierce had pronounced Ms. Hofer dead at 3:20 p.m. in Garden County and said that the cause of death was whole-body severe trauma caused by a two-vehicle collision.
For what purpose was the document offered?
Testimonial purposes, Your Honor. It was offered for the purpose of...
What was it offered to prove?
It was offered to prove her cause of death. And that's exactly what gets us into a mess here. It was offered to prove her cause of death.
Was the cause of death in dispute?
The cause of death, well, that, of course I want to pick at your question, Judge. Was it in dispute? It is a shortcut to say there was a wreck, someone died, the defendant was driving drunk. That's a shortcut to say that. But the law does not allow for proof by assumption. If the state wants to incarcerate someone for the rest of his life, which is exactly what's going on here, then it's not too much to ask that for each critical element of the offense, that the state present a witness who can be cross-examined. And Mr. Hood did not waive his right to cross-examine on the element of the proximate cause of Ms. Hofer's death. That's a critical element in manslaughter. It's a critical element also in motor vehicle homicide Class 2 felony.
Was there any other evidence of death?
Was there any other evidence of death? The sheriff's deputy, I don't believe, testified as to the cause of death. I'm trying to remember right now, and I don't want to misspeak, but I think that when he arrived at the scene, I think that she had deceased at that time, but there was some time before she arrived at the scene.
Could the jury have found proximate cause from circumstantial evidence?
Could they have? They could have, but that does not mean that Mr. Hood gave up his right to cross-examine and confront witnesses on that element. And that's where the issue is. It is easy to say that we have a reasonable assumption here, that there was a wreck and somebody died. That's a reasonable assumption, but that's just not how it works. There is a right of confrontation, there is a right to cross-examine and challenge the evidence, and we can't get into a pattern where the state is allowed to present evidence and get convictions and what is fundamentally a life sentence based on a document with no opportunity to confront and no opportunity to cross-examine. Y'all can't be allowing that to become the law, and this is the case that unfortunately presents it, a hard case.
The jury could have found that the circumstance was
Judge Popick, it was not, and the reason why is because the state didn't produce any other evidence on that. Now, think about a case in which the state finishes its presentation of evidence and sits down and has not remembered to say that all these events occurred in Garden County. And but for that one little note, that's the end of the case. Charges are dismissed. And that's what happened here, too. There was no other evidence that proved the cause of death. And so if the death certificate were not critical, then why did the state want to offer it? What was the whole point of even offering the death certificate if not for the fact that they still needed to present evidence of the cause of death? Now, they didn't present Phil Pierce, who was the county attorney. He presumably was there in Garden County and available, but there was no showing by the state of Nebraska that he was unavailable. And when you look at the statute, which was, I got to look at the number on this so I don't forget it, 71605, which provides that a death certificate is going to be signed by the medical professional, physician, PA, or APRN licensed, who last attended the deceased, and has to be signed and include a statement of the cause of death, and says that a county attorney acting as coroner can do that, can fill that function, if the licensed medical professional wasn't there. In other words, the state had to make that showing that there was no licensed medical professional there. It's not too much to ask.
What kind of an objection did you make at trial?
Well, I didn't make any objection at trial because I hadn't been appointed yet. Mm-hmm. But the objection that was made at trial by his trial counsel was an appropriate objection. Objected based, I believe, on right of confrontation. I can be mistaken on this. I think he also objected on hearsay, but my focus is on the right of confrontation. It's not, the state's response to it was to say, well, the document has a seal. But just because there's a seal on the death certificate, just because it's self-authenticating doesn't mean it's self-admitting. Those are two different questions. Yeah, the document is self-authenticating. We can prove that it's a real death certificate. But the presence of that seal doesn't answer questions such as, well, did Mr. Pierce personally attend the death of Ms. Hofer and personally pronounce the cause of death based on his own assessment? Or did he get that opinion from somebody else? The seal on that document doesn't answer questions like, well, if he did get that opinion from someone else, was that person qualified to do it? Or did that person hear about it from yet another third or fourth party? The presence of the seal on the document doesn't answer any of those questions. And Mr. Hood had the right to raise those questions, had the right to challenge on that, and if the state couldn't go down the street and get Mr. Pierce to come in here and answer those questions, then the result should have been exactly the same as if they rested without saying all these events occurred in Garden County.
Before you exhaust your time, the issue of Birchfield refusal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Birchfield case and the refusal issue. The Birchfield case comes out in 2016. This wreck happens in 2013, and the trial happens in 2017. And there's a case from the U.S. Supreme Court called Teague versus Lane, T-E-A-G-E. And the Teague case articulated that I'm going to read the ruling in my own fabulous handwriting, that a case announces a new rule if the result was not dictated by precedent existing when the conviction became final. And so the few courts that have looked at the question of whether Birchfield applies retroactively have said that it does. And what that means is that when Birchfield was articulated, it said that back in 2013 that Mr. Hood had the right to refuse consent to this warrantless search of his blood. He had the right to do that. Now, if you look at the other rights that a person under police investigation absolutely has a right to invoke without any fear that it's going to be used as a penalty against him at trial, this is not new law. If I invoke my right to remain silent, the prosecution can't make pay about that in front of the jury. If I ask for an attorney and say I want to invoke my right to counsel, the prosecution can't make hay about that either. And they should not have been allowed to make hay to adduce the evidence and, more to the point, to argue about it, the fact that Mr. Hood had invoked a right that he had, which is to refuse consent to a warrantless search.
Other courts post-Birchfield address the argument you're making. relying on Birchfield, perhaps extending it further to say evidence of refusal. Has that been addressed by other courts?
I think that has been addressed by the cases that I cited in my brief, which were State versus Vargas, which is a New Mexico case from 2017, and the site there is 2017 Westlaw 4416107. And I would flip to the next page with the next case, but thankfully I'm out of time. So I thank the court for hearing argument in this case, and I'd ask the court to reverse the judgment of conviction.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Good morning. Please, the court. Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. If time permits, I'll address all three issues on appeal. I'll take the issues in the order in which they've just been argued. Starting with the admissibility of the admission of the victim's death certificate, we disagree that this was a confrontation violation. Both the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have explained that out-of-court statements and documents are not testimonial for purposes of the Confrontation Clause unless the primary purpose is to accuse a targeted individual of engaging in criminal conduct. So business records generally do not qualify as testimonial, even if the person or entity preparing them foresees that they may be used in a criminal prosecution, unless the sole purpose is for creating the records for purposes of a trial. That's obviously not the case with the death certificate, so we submit that there was no confrontation violation here. And the
have
death certificate...
Have we written on the use of death certificates being admitted into evidence?
I'm sorry?
Have we written on the issue of death certificates being admitted into evidence?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Why was the death certificate being entered into evidence?
My recollection was just to show...
Death?
Death, yes, the fact of death. Mr. Lucas said it was to show cause of death. That's not my recollection. It was just to show death, as I recall. So we would submit there was no error in admitting it. In any event, as we've argued...
Is there other evidence cause of death?
I think that's clearly inferable from the other evidence adduced at trial, which is, I think, why even if there was error here, it was harmless. When we look at the record, we know from Ms. Weinbender that the victim was driving prior to the wreck. When officers show up, Ms. Weinbender is the only one showing vital signs per the testimony. When the PA drives by to see if he can render any assistance, he's told that we have one fatality, two other individuals with injuries. And then I believe it was Deputy Ross said that after we wrapped up our investigation here, I went with Ms. Alford to the funeral home. So it was just clearly inferable, if not expressly proved by the state's case, that the victim died at the scene of the wreck and as a result of the wreck. And again, as we pointed out in brief, that it simply was not disputed at trial. There was no dispute on that issue. The defense itself took no issue with that and informed the jury that the crux of the case was whether the state showed that Mr. Hood was intoxicated at the time of the wreck. So for the sake of argument, even if the death certificate wasn't properly admitted, we submit that any error there was harmless.
Was there other, what was the other evidence, let's say it again, on cause of death?
On cause of death? Well, I think all of the things I just mentioned would necessarily show that the death occurred as a result of the accident. I don't know that there's anything above and beyond what I just laid out, but I think all of those things taken together would necessarily show that the cause of death was the accident.
I guess what's your understanding of cause, as in there's an accident, or cause is blunt force trauma, head brain injury, or heart attack, or a medical cause? What does cause mean in this context?
I guess in this
accident
context...
and a death, as distinguished from something medical in nature. What's cause mean?
I mean, sure, medically, cause could go further and mean something more, but I guess in this context, I don't understand the state as needing to prove anything more other than the fact that you were driving a motor vehicle.
But is the state's position to just need to show death as opposed to medical cause of death?
Yes. If there are no further questions on that issue, I'll move to the admissibility of the refusal to submit to the blood test. We maintain this evidence is properly admitted under U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in Neville and Birchfield itself, as well as this court's decision in State v. Rask.
Is it constitutional attack on 66197?
I didn't take it that way. If
doesn't subsection 6 say this evidence comes in for purposes of refusal?
It does.
Or for purposes of DUI?
Yes.
And we've said that before?
Yes.
Now this contention is that that's not okay based on virtue.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Constitutional challenge?
It's a constitutional challenge. I don't know if it's one toward the statute or not. I guess I did not take it as that. If that had been raised, I probably would have been arguing a waiver here for not properly presenting that issue below. So I didn't take it as such, Your Honor. If it is, I think it's not been properly raised and preserved to the extent it's a challenge to the statute. I just took it as a more general assertion, as a constitutional notion that Birchfield has indicated, or in the wake of Birchfield, you can't introduce evidence of a refusal in a DUI trial, and I think Birchfield itself indicates otherwise. I mean, Neville itself squarely addressed the issue and said, yes, you can bring this in. And then Birchfield goes on to, after rendering his decision, say, we do not call into question our prior decisions, saying, you know, implied consent laws are valid to the extent they impose civil penalties and evidentiary consequences, and citing to Neville and Missouri v. McNeely. So, I don't think we need to look any further than Birchfield here to say that this has not been called into question. And then when you look at the fact that, I mean, this court issued State v. Rask just 2 months later, Birchfield was not addressed in that opinion, of course, but it seems inconceivable to me that if Birchfield truly had indicated that refusals were no longer admissible in a DUI trial, that this court in Rask would have just said, well, let's just forge ahead and continue to do it anyway. To me, that doesn't add up. So we submit that the refusal was properly admitted in this case. I don't have much more to add on that unless the court has questions on that issue. Turning to the last claim, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim regarding trial counsel's failure to explore a diminished capacity defense. As set forth in our brief, we question whether they've raised a sufficient allegation of deficient performance on this claim. But even if they have, we would submit the record refutes this claim because the record shows that Mr. Hood knew what was going on. And he was not suffering from some mental defect or illness that hinders his ability to understand the nature and consequences of what was happening. Among other things, the record reflects that one of the EMTs at the scene spoke with Mr. Hood, testified that he was alert and conscious. Hood told him that he had broken an ankle, asked about the passengers in the other vehicle. Hood also conversed with Deputy Abbott on the way to the hospital and at the hospital. They spoke about what happened, the cause of the wreck, whether Hood had been drinking, whether Hood would submit to a PBT or a blood test, all of which Hood was able to discuss with no problem, as I understand it. Hood also conversed with the physician assistant at the hospital, Tracy Ray, who testified that he spent about 45 minutes with Hood that day, and while he did show some signs of confusion, he didn't show any signs of shock. He was neurologically intact based on the scans that they did, and the confusion appeared to be nothing more than being under the influence. And of course, we know that the blood alcohol concentration based on the test was 0.10. And then Ray also opined that Hood was competent to provide the blood sample they obtained, and he also overheard Hood make a phone call to his mother and say he needed money and he was in trouble. So in light of all of this evidence, we would submit the record reflects he knew what was going on. He knew the difference between wrong and right and was not suffering from a mental illness or defect.
Is there any significance to the narrative about lots of birds and so forth?
Well, as I recall the record, that was his explanation as to what happened and why the accident happened. Not, as Mr. Lupe said, that God was sending him messages. It was that, I guess God was just saying it's her time to go, was his explanation, not that God was talking to me and sending, showing me birds. I think that's a bit different than what the record reflects, as I recall it. So, no, I don't think there's any meaning to that, Your Honor.
How would a diminished capacity defense affect these charges? Is there an impact? Is there a valid defense?
Well, I'm not really even sure how that would work, Your Honor. I've been trying to think that through myself. And first of all, I'm not really even sure what they're pointing at here. When I look at their brief, they're saying, well, it could have been bipolar, it could have been schizophrenia, it could have been post-traumatic stress, it could have been alcohol-induced psychosis, it could have been the fact that he's a long-standing alcoholic and hasn't had enough treatment, it could have been the fact he's been abused by his dad and has been self-medicating. But the gist of it seems to be that he has a long-standing alcohol problem, and I don't see how that serves as a defense to drunk driving.
Motor vehicle homicide, is that specific intent crime? What have we said about that?
No, I don't. But as far as I'm aware, it would not be a specific intent. So I don't know what diminished capacity would do. Typically, it wouldn't be a complete defense. It would knock something down from one degree of intent to another. So if you don't have, say, first-degree murder, where you could go from first to second with the diminished capacity defense, I don't know what it does for you.
Can you explain your understanding of what you think was decided and what wasn't decided in Rask?
In terms of the evidentiary
consequences.
Well, Rask did not get to Birchfield and did not address this from a constitutional aspect, so I'm certainly not representing that it did. Rask really just dealt with, sorry if I could continue.
You may.
It was a situation where the refusal was not, it was either not post-arrest chemical test advisement, it was not given or not properly given, and Rask held that that's nonetheless admissible in a DUI trial. You can't prosecute for refusal if you don't properly give that advisement. But it was nonetheless admissible. So from a state law evidentiary standpoint, it was still
from
admissible.
From a state law evidentiary standpoint with respect to DUI charges.
Right.
But not necessarily refusal charges.
Right. Yeah, well, I don't think Rask addressed, and we aren't dealing with a refusal charge. Okay. At least that's not what they're contesting on appeal.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes.
There is no time for rebuttal. Ms. Schu-